This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. Iraq, until about 2 months ago, was one of the most modern and highly industrialized nations in the Middle East. Yesterday, a special United Nations team reported that Allied bombardment in the Gulf War was so destructive, so nearly apocalyptic, it said, that Iraq has been reduced to the state of a pre-industrial society. Former Washington Post investigative journalist Scott Armstrong is my guest today. He's the co-author of the best-selling book on the Supreme Court, The Brethren, and he's the founder of the National Security Archives, a foreign policy research institute. We'll be talking about what the media has covered and what it hasn't in the Gulf War. What kind of job have we in the press done, Scott?
I think the press has done a remarkable job of piecing together an intricate story of an American and allied force that bombed Iraq back to a pre-industrial age. What they haven't done is address some of the questions that led to the war and some of the questions that led to why we couldn't find a peaceful resolution of it. If you put all the press accounts end to end and read them and look thoroughly at what they tell you, you find that the press is ignoring the fundamental question. The United States apparently didn't want that war to end. They didn't want withdrawal by the Iraqis from Kuwait. They didn't want peace. What we wanted to do was go in and destroy the Iraqi fighting force. We wanted to teach Saddam a lesson. We wanted to destroy his military and thereby hopefully topple him. And in order to do that, we had to go to great lengths to distort the Soviet peace proposal. We then had to, you recall on the Saturday before the ground war began, there were stories about torture and mass executions of Kuwaitis by Iraqis in Kuwait City. Those turned out to be false. There were stories then as we began to go in of pitched tank battles. Those turned out to be false. And there were stories that the Iraqis were retreating under fire, but they were basically giving a good fight for it. Those appear to be false. What happened was the Iraqis ran away, albeit they ran away with as much loot and under atrocious conditions, I'm sure sometimes taking captives and taking hostages. Nobody's defending their actions, but they were running away. They were trying to get out. And we went, came in behind them. We strafed them. We bombed them. We still don't know how many casualties there are. All we can say is that of the 545,000 Iraqis that were supposedly in southern Iraq and in Kuwait at the beginning of the hostilities, that number is important because U.S. intelligence figures calculated all of our responses accordingly. If you add up all the numbers, the 65,000 prisoners, it's very difficult to get a firm number on the number of dead, but the numbers don't add up very high, and the numbers that were seen running away that were allowed to go retreat back into Iraq, you can account for somewhere between 150 or maybe 200,000 Iraqis. That leaves 300,000 Iraqis unaccounted for.
But what is it that you think is really going on here?
I think there was a massive intelligence failure along the way, that we really didn't have very good idea of how many troops there were, that they deceived us to some degree. But I think that the question that the press has to deal with is, what was the United States' intention? We don't expect the President of the United States in the middle of a war to tell us precisely how he intends to prosecute the war, to end the war, or to be totally candid. War is a brutal affair. We don't want, I even think, to know his most innermost thoughts in some cases. But the press has to address the questions that try and bring those out. If we didn't really want Iraq to withdraw cleanly from Kuwait, but we wanted the opportunity to destroy it, the press has to deal with that and deal with what that means in terms of an Iraq afterwards, a country that's been bombed back to, as somebody put it today, I think, a pre-industrial age. We have to understand what it's going to mean in the Arab world. We have to understand what it means for the lessons of the war. If we really didn't win this war in the sense that it was a pitched battle or that there was any military resistance, and in fact it was just a mad car race to get as far as we could and then declare it over and won, that's a much different proposition than having really fought a ground war and won it. And I think we have to understand that for the next time we get into a conflict.
Well, clearly the U.S. and its allies won, and Saddam Hussein's troops are out of Kuwait, and his future seems to be not very promising at all. So I think people may be somewhat confused as to what you mean as to whether we won or didn't win. Does it require the pitched battles in order to declare victory?
No, I think that we are victorious in the sense of having militarily defeated Iraq, no matter how you cut it. But there is a question, particularly about this final phase of the war, as to whether or not we won any sort of an encounter, or whether or not the other side forfeited the game and went home. And I think that's really what happened. And in the process of forfeiting the game and went home, while they were in the parking lot trying to get out of town, we slaughtered tens of thousands of people. And I think that raises questions that we want to deal with. I don't have the answers. I wish I did have the answers. We just were not able to get them. Remember, there was a press blackout for the first 2 days of the war. There were briefings right before and right afterwards, but those briefings now turn out to be largely inaccurate. The press has said they're inaccurate when they refer to individual briefings, and yet nobody's drawn the whole picture together, which is that for a week before the war, the ground war began, and the first few days of it, what we were being told as an American people was distorted. Our press understands it to be distorted now, and yet is not blowing the whistle on the process.
There is both in the history of ethics in the West, and in law, a question of proportionality. What we're hearing about conditions in Iraq certainly would suggest that it is nearly utterly destroyed, with very little destruction to the prosecuting side of this war. How do you see the coverage of that question? What are the implications for this country? What are the implications for the press attempting to deal with that matter?
I think the long-term historical implications for the United States and the West in the Middle East are going to be determined by what we decide happened there. And if the conclusion we come to is that rather than simply forcing Saddam back out and then taking the quite appropriate actions, I think, to get reparations and whatnot, instead we decided to punish and destroy an entire society, a society that we agree was misled and led by a madman during that period. If we intend to do that and to make them suffer for the next 20 years of rebuilding, then I think that that raises serious questions about how good our relations can be in the future, not just with the Iraqis, but with others in the Middle East. They're going to have to pick up the weight of that. I think these are the kind of moral questions. When we decided that we wanted to go ahead with a ground war, which is what our Congress ultimately allowed when they allowed the president to take up arms and allowed him the flexibility to do that, one of the reservations that was held was that the ground war is very unpredictable. It could lead to a great deal of loss of American life, but it's also very unpredictable. It's not like dropping a single bomb on a country and like a situation like Hiroshima, which the United States probably would not stand for again. If somebody had said, the President of the United States, in order to punish Iraq, after they've withdrawn, is going to drop a bomb that's going to kill 100,000 people, people would have said, no, that's outrageous, we won't do it. But the ground war may have had that effect. Now, it may be that the commanders of the ground war didn't understand that as it occurred. But I think we've got to unravel some of that to understand what the United States' responsibility is for it. None of this excuses what Saddam did or what Iraq did. None of it has to do with the other aspects of reporting. But we have an obligation to understand what we did, how we did it, why we did it, and our own moral justification for it. And we have some reason to make some judgments about that. That has not yet been done.
My guest is Scott Armstrong, a national security specialist and former investigative reporter at the Washington Post, among other places. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Scott Armstrong, investigative journalist, national security specialist in Washington. This latest report from the United Nations certainly suggests the enormous horror and suffering in Iraq right now. To what extent do you think the press, as well as television, have told American people what that really is, what the conditions in Iraq are, what the consequences of the war have been there?
The principal difficulty of the U.S. press in covering the war is that we were subject to the restraints and restrictions both on the Iraqi and U.S. sides of censors and largely of briefings and materials that were fed to us. We've seen smart bombs literally go inside doors, almost open the door, kind of the Edward R. Murrow of bombs. You were there. Come on in. Show you around the room. With television cameras, great precision, a sense that the United States was in control. And yet we've seen images but just a few out of Iraq, showing what happened when bombs went awry. It's recently been reported that the smart weapons, these very accurate precision weapons, were used for only 7% of the bombs, that something like 90-some percent of the bombs missed their targets. When you begin to think what that means, because most of these targets were in metropolitan areas, were in smaller cities, it means there was a tremendous amount of civilian destruction. Apart from just the civilian deaths that were caused, imagine if every city of 100,000 in America were basically destroyed, that the water supply was destroyed, the electric supply was destroyed, the telephone company was destroyed, all the factories were destroyed. There was nothing left. There was no public transportation system. Essentially, people were had to go get pots and go down to some well and pull water out and bring it back because that's what their life was. They had to scavenge for food. This is the kind of conditions that we're talking about in Iraq. It is, as it was described, pre-industrial. It's from a different age. We haven't seen this in a war before. In previous wars, when there's been massive destruction, there's been some repair, some response, something left to deal with it. We have a whole country that's still at war and has no ability to respond to these things. Because of the sanctions, nothing's coming in from the outside. People are literally sitting and starving to death, those that have the opportunity to starve to death because many of the rest are dying from disease.
I want to go back to this question of proportionality. It's a question that comes up even in the U.S. Constitution, in which we say there shall not be cruel and unusual punishment, and it pervades our thought over the last several centuries about just action. And so there's a question of proportionality in between the two sides in this war. There's also then are you also saying there's a question of proportionality in the press coverage that? When you say nobody has put the whole story together, that we haven't seen, I guess the question is, why haven't we seen that? Why hasn't the whole story been put together? You are at the center of the Washington Press Corps. Why do you think that's happened?
My fear is that the Washington Press Corps saw itself becoming increasingly unpopular as this war went on. We gave predictions and news analysis, which turned out not to hold up, albeit most of it came from Pentagon officials who themselves overestimated the amount of carnage that would occur on the American side, and so forth. And we became increasingly more afraid to report the unpleasant side of this war. The American public got behind it. They saw the canned televised briefings that the Pentagon put on. They saw many of them live. They saw the results of them in other newscasts. And they liked it. They liked the notion of being a winner and backing a winner. To now be the messenger that comes along and says, wait a minute, we didn't really win the game. The other side kind of forfeited, number one. Number two, when they got to the parking lot, we slaughtered a lot of them. And number three, while they were at the game, we destroyed their houses and they don't have anything to go back to. That's not the American way, and I think the press is reluctant to describe that. Part of it's a question of timing. We're not going to say it when American boys are coming back and being reintegrated into society. That's the legacy of Vietnam to some extent. We don't want to isolate and ostracize our fighting men. We also just don't know the answers. One of the problems of censorship is that it cuts you away. Sometimes there are rebuttals to some of these questions I'm raising. There may be some good answers. We don't get to know what they are when you have censorship.
Did you find that there was an extraordinary use of by journalists of the pronoun we throughout the coverage, a real identification between journalists and the military enterprise here? That the usual distance that journalists are supposed to feel toward their stories somehow evaporated?
I think there was a tendency to use we throughout the reporting of the war, journalists, many of them, were quite explicit about the fact they were United States citizens before they were journalists. And I find myself doing it sometimes. Even when I'm being critical of the military, I say, this is what we did, what we thought, what we said. The problem, I think, is that we can't expect reporters to be totally objective. We have to understand the perspectives they come with. And United States citizens, I think, have a particular legacy. We think in terms of our freedoms, our First Amendment being international, and we go abroad and we learn that that's not the case. We have to restrain ourselves and understand our subjectivity, but in fact, we're going to have it.
Once the war was over and General Schwarzkopf held his now famous press conference, in which he explained all of the tactics and the brilliant strategy that was used. There was that got a great deal of attention. How did you see that event? How did you see the coverage of that press conference, that victory press conference?
Well, there was a sense, I think, as the war ended and Schwarzkopf came forward to the final press conference, that we were watching Eisenhower emerge from Europe. That this was not just a press conference. This was the beginning of a political career. This was an event of a different sort, and the adulation that accompanied that event, I think, was a little unseemly for the press. Instead of attempting to ask important and difficult questions about what had just happened in the war. There were a couple, by the way, from the back of the room, and if you go back and look at the transcript of the press conference or look at the tape of it, you'll see that he basically has one of the better straight arms in the National Football League as he pushed people aside. But Schwarzkopf didn't answer anything he didn't want to answer, and what he did answer was treated as if it were a political campaign statement, not something that was news to be reported on.
Well, I do recall that Barbara Walters, in one of her reports, said that many people seemed to nearly fall in love with General Schwarzkopf, and after interviewing him, she could understand why.
Well, I think that General Schwarzkopf is a very bright and very persuasive individual. He has a force of character that shows that he's not going to be denied. And one of the problems I think that a reporter has is that you're not in a one-on-one or in a large group situation interviewing him, going to suddenly bring him to his knees with a tough question. If he doesn't want to answer it, you're not going to get there. You don't learn what General Schwarzkopf's strategy is. The weak points or the difficult questions aren't going to be addressed to him. They have to be addressed to people around him. They have to be taken from the circumstances and worked backwards. You have to raise questions. For example, a question of deception. We now know that the American press was deceived repeatedly during briefings on very important issues. It's still unclear, though, if the briefers knew that they were doing the deceiving or if they themselves were deceived. Were there whole levels of deception within the U.S. military command there, where some ranking officers didn't really know what was going on because they were going to go out and see the press? That seems to me to be incredible and incredibly dangerous.
What's an example?
Well, I think that General Neill, who I found to be a very interesting and persuasive figure himself, who did many of the briefings, had a very crisp, clear way of expressing himself. General Neill was busily telling us on Saturday a variety of things that turned out later not to be the case, or certainly don't seem to have stood up in terms of the right emphasis, in terms of both the atrocities going on in Kuwait. There were supposedly mass executions of Kuwaitis that don't seem to have occurred. But he referred not only to reports from the Kuwaiti resistance, but he said we had other intelligence means and we're pretty sure of these reports. He put a lot of emphasis on it. There was a later point where he was describing pitched tank battles, including the tank battle by the airport. Well, it turns out it may have been a tank battle, but the only tanks were the American tanks. There were trucks on the other side, and it wasn't a pitched battle. And I think there were a number of things like that where it's just the Washington Post has made it clear that what he said was wrong. It was inaccurate. But it's not yet clear if he knew it was inaccurate at the time. He says he didn't. He says he believed it at the time. And, of course, a ground war is confusing. But these seem to be the types of things that look like they were methodically miscommunicated to the press. And it raises questions about whether or not Neill himself was fooled.
Or complicit.
Or whether he was complicit in what was a major perception management campaign organized against the American press.
Perception management campaign. Does that mean lie?
To the military, it doesn't mean lie. In the military terms, you organize the way in which people order their thoughts. And if they come to a conclusion that something other than what is true, that's their problem.
What do you think the effect of running those briefings was, as simply you can call it either as an information or a propaganda technique? Well, I mean, those briefings ran on many television stations, and they ran on National Public Radio Network. Would you have run them raw like that?
Well, I think it was a service to run them raw. I think that while they were a very successful propaganda technique for the American military, clearly the big difference between Vietnam and today is the fact that the military has very sophisticated abilities to express themselves and to control the media. And the media, which is not a monolithic enterprise like the military, which is not controlled, which is not, in fact, coordinated. Looks silly when it asks the same question five times, or it asks questions that would be absurd for the military to answer in an open setting that would give Iraqis information. So it tends to elevate the military and tends to demean what the press does. And the downside of it was that it convinced the American public that the press were a bunch of bozo stenographers who asked dumb questions, occasionally know when to laugh at the right joke. When in fact the real reporting that occurred in the Persian Gulf from the experienced reporters didn't come out of the briefings. They might use the briefing comment to compare it with what they actually found, but it was because they went and they started interviewing people. And a free press works when you have 1,000 reporters out there working on 100 stories until one or two or three reporters discover something that's new, begin to print it, the other reporters pick it up, and information begins to bubble up to the top. The problem with the briefings was you had 1,000 reporters following five or six stories, largely of the military's choosing.
My guest has been Scott Armstrong, an investigative journalist and founder of the National Security Archives in Washington, talking about what the press has and hasn't yet accomplished in covering the Persian Gulf War. This is Fresh Air.